by the age of 20 to 21, I was earning $300,000 to $400,000 a month.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there. All right, we are live with Johnny Volk. Johnny, what's going on, brother?
What's up? How you guys doing? Glad to be here. You guys have interviewed some awesome people, so I'm excited to, you know, just be counted among worthy to be on your podcast.
You for sure meet the criteria of awesome people. So I wanted to actually start things off here, and we'll probably zigzag a bunch throughout this entire conversation. But I know I had a tweet the other day because it's just something that was on my mind in terms of Gio and I, when we sold our last business like a couple of years ago, when we were selling it, it made a ton of sense to sell, like thin margins, entirely relying on Amazon, you know, tough cash cycles, all that kind of stuff. And so when we sold it, we were super excited because cash in the bank, we're young, still in college, and like life was good. Now, as I've gone through a couple more years and met some cool people who are running really interesting businesses, the more I think about this kind of stuff, I'm like, I would probably, like, unless the business isn't operating at its greatest potential, I probably would almost never want to really sell a business again. Like, it's, you lose all of your cash flow as soon as you sell it. And I guess this kind of comes into where like the terms come into play, but like you get a big lump sum of cash, but like you're selling out that cash flow. Like, why not just go and consistently build it up, especially if it's a really good business with high profit margins? Like, just finding that opportunity and starting a business is so freaking hard that, like, you know, when you sell it, it's like, all right, well, now I got to go and either buy another business or start this again. So I basically made a whole tweet saying, like, why would you ever sell a good business? And you being a person who still currently owns, I don't know if it's a minority or majority share of the business that you sold, carcovers.com, you did recently sell your business. And I think a lot about like that whole Alex Hormozi quote where it's like, you'd only really want to sell if you think the party is over. You think the party's still going on? Like, you want to like retain some or whatever. And so your response was really good to my tweet. It said something along the lines of like, hey, and verbatim here, now that I've had my first big exit and I'm well diversified, my future business will not be for sale. So let's maybe go and kick things off in terms of like, why sell in the first place? Then I've got a whole slew of questions after that.
Yeah, sure. So I can tell you kind of the background, but I've been doing online marketing and building online businesses since I was a young kid. So I'd built the carcovers.com business for over 15 years, really reinvesting profits over and over and over again. And it's nice to have a cash flowing business, but after that long of, I've had many ups and many downs of, you know, Facebook account gets banned or something, and then you're like, I got to rework to get this back. And then Google issues, and you lose your rankings. So the reason why I sold my first business is really to lock in that like decade of compounding. And so that gave me enough where I never, you know, F you money, never have to worry about my next venture. And so I do agree. Now that I've sold it, it's like, man, I miss the credit card rewards and the all these like little intangible benefits that are so nice, being able to withdraw a big chunk of money after you've had a successful year. But now that I've locked that in, the next business that I build is going to be to continue to reap all those intangible benefits, tax benefits and such. So that's why I locked in.
Did you have a specific game plan in mind on what you wanted to do with the money, or was it more of, hey, I just want to take some cards off the table, I'm all in on this one thing, and, you know, get some cash and then figure it out there? Or did you have kind of a strategy going in of what you were going to do with the money?
So I built the business up to over 20 million in revenue, and once I got to that point, it became like the ups became really great and the downs became really bad. You know, like 1 month we lost 150 grand or something like that. And it's like, like that's all on me, right?
What do you mean you lost? Does that mean like the revenue was down that month, or like the money left the bank account and didn't come back?
Yeah. It was just a down month where we like everything that went wrong could go wrong. It's like Google changes to algo and our ranking shifted, and then like we had issues with our ad accounts. And it's like, oh man, all right, I'm ready to get out of the ups and downs of this daily stress of like this business could still go to zero, like 15 years into it. So once it hit 20 million, I knew I needed to take some chips off the table, and it was sizable enough that, you know, I didn't have to worry.
And you sold, because you didn't sell 100% of the business, you sold the majority. And then so you're still kind of like invested to go and incentivize to make things work properly and grow the business, right?
Yeah, the way that most private equity with companies of my size, they want to have the leadership still stay on. So I've retained a minority stake in it. I'm still on a CEO for kind of the first couple of years and working on the, you know, that transition plan. So it's not like Thrasio and some of these FBA aggregators. It's like, oh, we'll just buy it and you take it. And day one, you're like, you know, just give us 90 days and you're out. It's not like that with these other businesses, at least in my instance.
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. And the one thing I just wanted to quickly ask, I don't know how public you are about the sale price of the business. So we don't even have to get into that necessarily, but you made a comment that I always just like to kind of understand how people think about, whereas like when you sold it, you kind of get like that element of like the FU money of like, hey, like I no longer have to like worry about things. I don't have to answer to people. Like I'm not getting, you know, I'm not sending a bunch of resumes in the foreseeable future. I would love to maybe know what your definition of that level is, right? Like, is that in the 10 million range? And I don't know if this is going to reveal other numbers, right? But more just like how you even think about that in general.
Yeah. For me, it was being a multi-deca-millionaire. So yeah, over 20 million.
That's yeah. And then when you sell too, do you try to go and incentivize that to like reduce tax burden? Like, I don't know how you structure all of that stuff.
Yeah. So we did a bunch of stuff to try and not get taxed out, you know, the wazoo. So we did some like opportunity zones and things where you can roll that money into tax deferred strategies. But I still had a large tax bill. And actually, because the taxes were so complex, I ended up overpaying my taxes by like 800,000, and I just got it in 2022. So they're like, the government was just sitting on 800 grand for until April this year.
Did you realize that like the second you press send, or was it like the accountant send you an email being like, hey Johnny, like just noticed this going back through the books?
Yeah, well, once they like, because a lot of stuff we were still waiting on, so we had to file the extension, but you have to pay. And so as they started going through stuff, they're like, oh, you did this. I didn't know you did this conservation or, you know, whatever. And so we found the extra.
I will say that sucks, because there's just like opportunity costs and like the time of the market and all that kind of stuff that like you ended up overpaying, but substantially better. I got a text from a friend, and I will not say the name of someone who sends me a screenshot from his accountant just saying, hey, we just went through everything. Looks like we were wrong and you underpaid by 80,000 last year. And he was like, well, fuck, like I don't want to go and have to like pay this additional amount. So at least getting, you know, the 800 back is substantially better than underpaying.
Yeah. And it felt like free money. So I was like, all right, we're redoing the backyard. And
like, what was the game plan with the money? Was it just to kind of sit on it for a minute and relax and decide what's next?
Yeah. So the day that I got this massive, you know, 8-figure wire into my account, and I show my wife and she's like, oh, cool. Like, you know, it's so anticlimactic. And then just, what do we do now? So we just sat on it for a little while. We didn't do anything crazy, but we knew that we wanted to start kind of looking into short-term rentals and real estate. So I've got a real estate portfolio, not short-term rentals, but we love going to Tahoe and some of these other places. And so we wanted to start looking into those kind of diversifications.
Yeah. So I think that's something that became a big theme in the responses to that tweet that I made too, was that you want to take some chips off the table and diversify. I'd love to maybe get an understanding too, in terms of like how, so when did you sell the business? What year was it exactly?
December 2020.
It's been 1.5 years. At this point now, would you mind, and if this is too personal, no need to share, but like I'd love to maybe know like how percentage wise you're allocated to different classes, right? Like maybe like X percentage is still tied up into car covers and like the business you're growing there, and then like other ones are more tied up into real estate or private equity or whatever.
Yeah, so I've still got a good sizable amount, probably 8 figures, tied up in the car covers business, especially as we've push to grow and we're making acquisitions. And so the goal is to grow that business. And so I'm still tied to it and making sure that that's going to be successful. Then I have a big majority of my finances in index funds. Probably about $2 to $3 million I've invested in early stage ventures. So I've invested in over 100 startups.
Is that through your deal flow or is that through funds?
Both. Some I was able, just because I've been in e-commerce for so long. For example, a company Postpilot, I know the CEO, he came to me, he's like, hey, we're looking to raise, you know, you interested? And so I was able to invest directly, and a few other companies invest directly, but mostly funds. And I just love early stage companies. So anytime I can add value or see something that I'm like, yeah, this is going to work. Those are the ones that I pull the trigger on. But
do you still have kind of current plans on where you're putting the money, or is it pretty much all set? The things you know, your index funds, early stage, you got maybe some cash now, and is your main focus just keep growing car covers, or are you still kind of playing around in different investments and trying to figure out where to put it all?
So I'm pivoting a lot of it to real estate and index funds, just because that money is like low. I've taken so much risk building car covers and the other businesses that it's like, okay, I'm going to pivot this into more safe, stable, boring assets. And then take another shot at another business down the future and be more high risk. And also the venture stuff is pretty high risk. So you expect, yeah, you know, 70% to go to zero. So
yeah, that's cool to think about. Do you, what percentage would you say you keep in cash too? And I ask these just because, like, I know during like inflation, like we're seeing now, cash is an absolute anchor. Yeah. But maybe going into a recession, cash can be king. And so how do you think about your cash allocation right now?
I actually keep very little in cash. So I put most of it into index funds, and then I have a asset-backed loan. So if I need instant cash, I can get, you know, up to $5 million or whatever it is, just as a low interest access. So that most of the stuff that I'm doing, I don't need like a huge amount of cash for, just living expenses and such.
How do you view it from the cash flow side? Is that where the real estate kind of comes in handy, where you can get, you know, rental income, et cetera, for those living expenses then?
Yeah. So I'm still on salary at the company, which is, it's, okay, you know, since I'm CEO of a private equity backed company, it's pretty substantial. That covers most of my living expenses, or I would say all of them. And then the real estate I've owned for so long that it cash flows really nicely. So one building I bought for $1.7 million in 2013, it's worth like $6 million now, and I rent it out for like $25,000 a month, and it costs me less than $10,000 a month in mortgage. And I've got, you know, another commercial property as well that cash flow is like $6,000 a month.
Wow, so that's amazing! Damn, good for you. I think, like, and I have one last personal question, because I know we're just grilling on personal finances right now, which is not meant to be the entire point of this podcast. I just think that people find this stuff really interesting because no one talks about it. My last question is, at least on this topic, is just like, do you manage all of this yourself? And if so, like, what are your thoughts on like typically what happens? People have a big exit like you did, and they'll go and hire somebody just to go and like allocate everything for them. Do you agree with that philosophy, or do you like kind of like having control of everything?
So I did hire somebody at the beginning. Like Wells Fargo convinced me, oh, why don't you put like a small amount in this? Like I put a few million dollars with them. And I said, you got to beat the S&P, or I'm just going to pivot it to index funds. And then they were like, oh, well, like, you know, we may not be beating it, but the big thing is when there's a correction, we protect you from downside. And of course, like as things go down, it didn't do as well as the S&P. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to pull the money out and stop paying the like 80 basis points that you guys are charging or whatever it was. So I do everything self-managed now.
In terms of harping on like Geo shits all over financial advisors and wealth managers, like probably 4 or 5 times a week.
There's so much research on it that show like, and you can't beat an S&P index fund. Yeah. Like it's not going to happen no matter who you hire, right? Give it 10 years and everyone underperforms. Yeah. You get three people that don't, right?
Exactly. And the only way I could see it being interesting is like they've got access to certain like private equity funds. And I've seen certain private equity funds that are like, we've returned, you know, 35% over the last 15 years. And that's where it becomes a little bit more interesting, but mm-hmm. I almost want to go out and find those private equity firms myself first, paying somebody.
I also think too, someone at your level too, like you can probably get access to a lot of those people too. Like, I think if you were very not public about some of the things that you're building and like didn't have like probably the network that you would have, it would be much more difficult. Like if you were just like, I don't know, investing somebody else's money, then it's like you're knocking on doors and sending cold emails, but like you can probably get enough introductions to get access to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. We'll see. I haven't done a ton of private equity investments. I've done a few, but most of the times the minimums are within the range of what I do.
On the side of not necessarily PE investments, but you've done a decent amount of acquisitions at this point, right? And you're looking at deals as well. Can you maybe chat about like, how does that kind of fit into your portfolio? But I believe it's more of a platform play, right? With their mm-hmm. kind of sub brands underneath Car Covers, or what's the strategy there? And what have you guys been doing?
Yeah. So, we've done really good at capturing a lot of the car cover market, and it's very search intent, right? Like people search for a car cover. They're not, if you've never used a car cover, you're like, why would people do that? But there's a subset of people who do. So we did really good with that. And then we realized that those customers that care about their cars care about like the interior of their cars and keeping it clean and all that kind of stuff. So it's when I partnered with private equity, the play was let's pivot this from a car cover company to a car protection company. And with the funds that they bring along and my expertise in this space, we've been able to partner and start to acquire like a brand like hailprotector.com, which is a patented inflatable car cover that protects against hail. And we own some like utility patents that we've purchased, and we're going out and acquiring these different companies within that space. We have over 500,000 customers so that know us and trust us, and we can email too. So once we launch one of these ancillary brands, then, you know, we can cross promote pretty successfully.
You have an incredible brand in the space too. I mean, in part from the domain, and that's, I think that's a whole story in and of itself of purchasing the domain and making the big bet there. So if you want to get into that, we can. But I think one thing that kind of comes up pretty frequently in e-commerce now is like this need for like kind of like a hero SKU and build the marketing around that. But like the business that you're going after is like, I would imagine you have thousands of SKUs because there's thousands of different car models. Is the back end of this business, would you call it like a moat almost, because like people probably don't want to get into how, I don't know, like to compete with you, you can either go and launch Nissan car covers and like just sell like these 7 or 8 car covers, or if you actually want to be competitive, you have to go and be willing to invest in the inventory for thousands and thousands of different SKUs. Is your operations on the back end like logistically very complex?
Yeah, it's pretty challenging, and that is definitely a moat. The domain name and just the challenge of we sell for over half a million different vehicles, including like jet skis and ATVs, UTVs.
Does that mean you have 500?
They must be all made to order, right?
No. So
how many SKUs are on the back end then?
But thankfully, like because everything, the vehicles are very commonly the same shape and size, we'll have one SKU that fits, you know, a range of vehicles that are, you know, all the vehicles that are 86 inches wide, long by, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, this ATV cover fits all this. But we do have many hundreds of SKUs. And with that, we're able to fit every shape and size of a vehicle just about.
This is probably such a niche question, but I'm thinking like back to the days of like doing some product testing with like some of my own stuff of like, mm-hmm. you know, we would like make sure everything was good and compliant. Like, are there, when you were first starting this out and like adding new SKUs to your inventory, are you like, okay, great, the Hummer SKU is in, let's go to a Hummer dealership and make sure that this fits on all of their cars? Like, did you have to like find all of these cars to test the product on?
We did do a lot of testing. Yeah. Thankfully, when we first started, we were able to kind of take somebody else's product and, you know, brand it our own. And then over time, we've iterated it into our own, and then made like, you know, 100 extra different sizes and SKUs and fits. So we've really pioneered, it's called semi-custom, where we have this, like in the car cover business, and this is probably too much, but they have like the universal Walmart, which small, medium, large, and then they have the made to order, like WeatherTech, for example, and then we're right in the middle. And we've kind of, we weren't the first, but we were one of the pioneers of that middle range semi-custom. And we're able to take over the market that way.
What do your backend logistics look like in terms of manufacturing and distribution?
It's pretty complex, and we've got a large warehouse, 40,000 square feet, and then one in California that we just closed. We're gonna migrate over to Memphis as well, but that one was 30,000 square feet.
You buying these or leasing them?
I bought all the buildings personally. Yeah.
Then do you then lease it back to the company?
Definitely. And so just to touch on the building thing, I've always liked to diversify as much as I could along the way. So as I'm rolling profits into the business, if I could roll it into something that's going to be an asset for me, people are saying like, oh, you should spend the 300 grand or whatever you had to spend for the down payment on building your business. But I wanted to diversify, and it turned out to be an incredible asset for me, 9 years later.
This will be a very specific question, but when you're trying to go get the financing for it, did the bank, I'm assuming you gave them some sort of pro forma or market rents, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How did that work with it being your own, like you being the tenant? Is there conflicts there? Were there issues trying to get the financing?
No, the company had to guarantee it. I didn't have to do a personal guarantee because I put 15%. That was their limit. If you put 15% down or more, then you don't have to do a PG, personal guarantee. But so that's what I did. And just the company was kind of on the hook for making sure that they could pay it.
Connor, we're doing something wrong. We're putting 30, 40% down with all personal
guarantees. It's a different time too. I don't know how it would be currently, but
yeah, hopefully Gio and I have a lot more money in 5 years or we're going to be bankrupt. yeah, maybe I'm not even going to try to joke about that again. I had another question here that kind of pertained a little bit more towards the sale of your business here when you were kind of talking about that. Like you had a pretty good point, which I think is like the cliche saying of like, focus on the journey, not the destination. Like you got this awesome 8-figure wire into your bank account one day when you sold the business. And you, sounds like you and your wife turned to each other like, nice. Like, and then just kind of like proceeded on like with the rest of the day, maybe got a nice dinner that night. With now that you kind of like are in this like comfortable position, pretty diversified, you've had like, you've hit that destination. Does your approach to business, whether that's building, buying, or whatever, do you kind of like change how you work on a day-to-day basis now? And maybe like you're still thinking about like that destination of like, oh man, like, you know, if we can build this car covers portfolio up to like hundreds of millions, whatever like that, like then I'll be super content. Or is it like every day that you approach it, you're like, I really just enjoy what I'm doing right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I personally find fulfillment in other ways. So money has always been important, and it definitely increases like life quality. But my wife and I are big philanthropists. So we've given close to $10 million away in our lifetimes. Yeah. And that's where we actually find most of our fulfillment. So our whole reason for making money is so that we can have an impact, because we think that impact is like one of the few things that after a certain amount of money, you can't really, your life's not really going to change unless you get to like 100 million and getting a private jet and stuff. And you've got a few hours a month that you're flying private and feeling good about yourself. It doesn't really change. So the whole reason that we want to keep growing our business is to earn so that we can have impact.
I mean, that's an impressive amount to have donated. So good for you guys on that. What sort of, projects are you guys putting money into from that perspective? Do you have your own charity that you're running, or are you just kind of picking interesting, things that you think are fulfilling that you want to give back to?
So my wife and I are both Christian. So a lot of Christian organizations, but a lot dealing with like we support some orphanages overseas in different countries. a lot to deal with kids. We just started looking into this one called Foster the City, where it's like a foster program. And you can either support by being a foster parent, or you can help kind of financially come alongside these foster parents. Just church organizations and things that help people for free.
Johnny, how old are you, out of curiosity?
I'm 35. I started really young.
Dude, that's insane. Like giving away 10, most people don't make 10 million in their life. You've given away 10 million at the age before the age of 35, right? Like that's damn good for you, man. That's really incredible. And super impressive.
Thank you. I started when I was, 11, I started programming. So I was like building websites as a young kid. And then, by the age of 20 or so, you realize pretty quickly that like building websites is fun until nobody like visits it. So I'm like, how do I get people to my websites? By the age of 20 to 21, I was earning 300 to 400,000 a month. With these websites that, I'd learned how to do online marketing. And it started out with I bought this arcade website and I realized I'm earning like 5 cents per visitor. And I'm like, okay, where can I go buy traffic for 4 cents? This is like before Google was doing a quality score and all that kind of stuff. So I'd go buy traffic for like 4 cents a click. And this started this like journey down where I'm earning a few hundred bucks a day, and I'm like, how can I make this earnings per visitor 10 cents?
Playing the arbitrage game, getting it up there a little bit more. That's incredible. First of all, I had no idea. Did you go to college?
I dropped out.
Okay, that makes a ton of sense. I would like you're making college tuition money in 1 year, like for like the full 4 years. Like I absolutely would have dropped out as well.
I was like
Are you making 300,000 or 400,000 a month?
Yeah. I'd be in like a classroom and I'm like getting a call from this like person trying to make a deal with me. I'd run to like the printer room or whatever, and I'm having this like multi-million dollar call.
Oh my god, dude, that's first of all, your story is so much more badass than ours. But I was gonna say, like, I so remember when we sold our business through the brokerage, I had to get a call to like approve the wire going through, and I was in it's like a senior year, so I was taking like some sales class or something, maybe sales performance class, something like that. And I step out in the hallway to go and like talk to the brokerage or bank to confirm the wire and like have it going, it sent through. And I remember so vividly in my head, some like old cranky administration lady walking by. I was like, you shouldn't like you shouldn't be on the phone in the hallway, like get back to class. And I was like, no, I was like, I promise you, this is more important than class. But yeah, that like, I would have totally dropped out. Like, that's incredible. This is actually,
it's pretty insane.
It's funny. Like this is actually a question that I had, because I know you kind of like when you hear a lot about marketing today, I think the game has changed exponentially compared to where it was like 10 years ago, where today it's a lot more about like people really try to emphasize the brand element of a lot of things and like kind of like high level, like all white hat kind of approaches. But like you lived through those days of like a lot of affiliate marketing, which is like the like, hey, listen, we're getting people to websites, we're getting eyeballs, we're getting clicks, and we're charging ad revenue on it. And I think it was a lot more of like the affiliate and performance marketing. And a lot of those guys today, like yourself included, would probably run circles around like the modern marketer, because like you're very programmed and like engineered and to think about like performance, not necessarily just like, does this look good, but it's like, is this going to get a sale out of it? And you think about things a little bit more that way. I would love to maybe just kind of get some, I don't know, war stories or like your thoughts on like how this has maybe evolved over the past like 10-ish years or something like that, and how your marketing's changed.
I've kind of rode the waves over the years, and that's something that I would say to your audience. Like, there's these waves, like I would say probably most recently, like NFTs or crypto is a wave of these big money-making opportunities. And so when I was as a late teenager, early 20-year-old kid, affiliate marketing really started taking off. And the advertising networks like Google and stuff, they were so much more simple, where you could even do a direct offer. So it's like freecreditreport.com, and you just make a campaign and put like freecreditreport.com directly into the ad thing with your affiliate link. You're not making any website like super simple, right? And you're just arbitraging value. But that changed pretty quickly, and it became like more difficult. And then you'd have to build website with landing pages and try and offer value. And then Facebook too, in the early days, I was actually one of the first person to write a Facebook advertising guide. So I sold it on ClickBank and made hundreds of thousands of dollars selling that. And that guide is like so out of date now. It's completely different. You used to be able to target by like age range and like exact demographics and all these things where you're like, oh, do you age 21 and need car insurance? I mean, it's so different now.
Sold it on ClickBank, does that mean you just put up like a listing there and other people drove affiliate traffic? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so I had my own list. So I used to be a blogger. I was one of the first kind of like build in public guys. So I
as one of the first on everything type of guys, apparently.
So I had a blog with like 66,000 subscribers, and I built my like affiliate money. I'd post like monthly earnings report and stuff from like zero. And as I started, you know, earning 80,000, 100,000, you know, 200,000, more and more people started like following along. And then I used that to launch an affiliate marketing guide, which got tens of thousands of downloads. And then the Facebook ads guide, which, you know, sold hundreds of thousands of dollars worth. So,
fuck. Man, when I hear this kind of stuff, it makes me just want to do so much more. It happens every time. But like, okay, so the thing I want to kind of take out of this, and then maybe we shift from like how that all worked, because those were very much so days of like arbitrage, performance driven. Like, and what's kind of nice too is, and I'm not saying this is you at all, but more so in the lines of like, a lot of performance marketers back in like 2010 didn't really have to have like reputational stake or risk or anything like that. And that's like, you could send like 2 to 3 emails a day to somebody for over like, you know, 30 days and like, know like, hey, I don't really care what happens out of this. It's like, it's a website, like I'm anonymous and like, I don't really have to deal with the repercussions there. These days, it's a lot more like, yo, like word gets around very quickly through Reddit and Discord and Twitter and whatever of like, don't give your email to that guy because he is going to spam the hell out of you. And so it's a little bit of a different game there. But I think it sounds like you were just incredibly early to so many things, whether it was e-commerce or affiliate marketing, and the way you're kind of approaching this stuff. Maybe fast forward to today, sounds like maybe the quick and easy answer of it is crypto. Maybe, but like, are there specific things that you've seen over the last couple of years where like you want to invest a lot of time and energy into that maybe doesn't pertain to
I like how you phrased it with like the big waves, right? Like
yeah. Is there like a wave that you think like 21-year-old Johnny would want to like go back to and like probably spend a lot of his time working on right now?
Yeah, it's and one thing I love about Twitter is you get to see these waves a little bit more evidently, where when I was first starting, I'd like have to go deep on like SitePorn forums and these other places. And I just spent all my time on the internet, right? So that's how I was able to kind of find these things and be early. Now I do think crypto is a wave. Right now we're in a little bit of a down part of that wave. but I had friends, you know, getting deep on NFTs and getting access to whitelists. And because they're on the whitelist and in this small like type community, they'd be able to turn like 0.2 ETH into 0.8 ETH like day one and just flip the floor price, right? So I think there's so many opportunities like that where if you just go deep on one particular thing that you know is on the big rise. One thing that I do see that seems to be more and more common, like what you guys are doing is buying like these storage units and doing some of these sweaty startups, you know, buying a trailer and renting it out. And I love that. I just go crazy over that kind of stuff. I see it on TikTok all the time where this guy's like, oh, I bought a vending machine and, you know, I'm making $600 a week or whatever it is.
It's so funny seeing like the juxtaposition of that between like the Tai Lopez Ferrari ads that we would all see in like 2017. And now someone's like, hey, listen, like screw e-commerce. Like instead we're going to go and buy some dumpster truck rentals over here. And it's like, exactly. Like people love the, before it was all about how can I make money in front of a screen? Now we're seeing a lot of like, oh, what's cool is making money like not in front of a screen. Like, how can you go and like
reverting
like,
back?
Yeah, so but I think part of that too is because like the operators are so not sophisticated in those niches. Like, really smart people don't want to work hard, and it's very easy to sit in front of a computer for 8 hours a day, right? And just like kind of like type away and do that stuff. And I'm not saying that like all of internet marketing is easy. If anything, it's way more competitive now. But the competition pool is significantly dropped in those SMBs, and so you can find a good amount of like alpha there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say like, if you don't have any capital, you have like capital doing like the pressure washing or some of these service businesses where you can earn probably as much as somebody with a college degree pretty quickly. I think that's a great way where you start to self-finance, and then you can start to look into some of these other more capital intensive things. I still think there's a lot to be said about e-commerce. I love e-commerce. I'll probably always have that, but maybe instead, you know, you build a TikTok. This is what my wife is doing right now. She's got 127,000 TikTok followers, right? And she's like home decor, home DIY, all that kind of fun stuff. And we're going to use that to create unique home decor products and then use her TikTok audience to sell it. And one of the hardest things with e-commerce is getting that audience. If you build it, then that's when you can like, so a lot of times we build the product first and then we're like, how do we sell it? But now we're trying to pivot into this. Let's build the audience first and then let's find things to sell. So,
which is kind of what you did almost to the extent with car covers, right? And then you buy the different brands underneath because you already have that audience and now you can sell different products. That was definitely the biggest issue we had with, you know, selling on Amazon is that you never own your customer. We could never shoot out an email blast. We had selling hundreds of thousands of units a year and we had no email list.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So every time you launch, it's a whole different, I don't know, just kind of hate FBA at this point.
I will say FBA is like super, I'd say it's like 5 to 10 times easier in terms of just day-to-day operations. Like I know a guy who's like, oh yeah, I work like a few hours a week and making, you know, six figures or whatever. I'm like that would not be possible if you're running like a Shopify store unless you got things automated like crazy.
Yeah, because you don't have to worry about the marketing as much, which is nice. Yeah. Like they're driving the majority of traffic, which is like honestly the biggest part of the battle of running your own Shopify store is like how do I get traffic to that store?
But you have to worry about like, Amazon shutting your store down and going to zero.
Yeah, exactly. There's some major pros. Owning your own audience is probably the biggest one and not having to worry about.
So I think Thrasio is struggling right now. A lot of the aggregators are having a really difficult time. I don't know if it's, you know, a debt side and maybe just poor timing, but I think they're all not doing too well right now.
Yeah, I have a couple friends that sold to Thrasio and some others and the businesses they sold have just gone just continually down. I think Thrasio underestimated the amount of work that like they think, oh, I'm just going to take it over and it's going to be fine and we can scale up infinitely. But I think they underestimated the amount of work that these operators put into it. It is still a good amount.
Every prospectus I've ever read has said that they spend 5 hours a week on the business, and every business owner I've ever met has never spent less than 40. So there's some discrepancy there. I also think the Thrasio guys, it sounds like, are probably very good at looking at like all of these businesses probably make a ton of sense on a spreadsheet. Like, oh wait, you mean like payback period in 3 years and we bring in like one marketer and maybe we can get that down to like 2.1 or something? Like I think a lot of that stuff makes sense there. Then you don't realize like, oh yeah, it is actually a lot of work like maintaining and operating all of these.
Yeah. It's more than just buying inventory and sending it in for sure.
One thing that you, I think, are in a unique position to answer, because I know that you've gone down the crypto rabbit holes, and I know that obviously very, very proficient in e-commerce. There's a lot of hype right now, maybe less so in the last month or two, but in the last year around like NFTs being this like super valuable construct for e-commerce of like build your community and like build it through NFTs. And like, I struggle a lot with that because in my mind, I'm like, okay, come on, Connor, like just be more forward thinking, like, I don't get it now, but can I see the big picture? Can I see how we can get there? So I struggle between like trying to be more forward thinking and like agreeing with that. And then it also just being like, dude, this is such like, this isn't a necessity at all. Like nobody really needs these NFTs. Like unless like the best use case I can see out of them would be like limited edition Yeezy drops or like Nike doing some kind of crazy collab or something like that. But like for the most part, I would argue that like 99% of operators don't need it, and they're actually just a huge distraction and waste of time. Would you agree or disagree?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it is probably a distraction for most people. Again, I'm a ride the wave kind of guy. So if things are going up with NFTs again, and you can make it work, and then, you know, maybe as long as you don't put your reputation on the line, you know, offer some value with it, then. But I for the most part, I agree with you. Absolutely.
I think Connor's just upset because the top shot that he convinced me to go in on with him probably at a dollar right now.
Yeah, Gio and I, this is
a lot on top shot.
When was this? This is a year and a half ago. Gio and I were just like over in Colorado, and I was like, yeah, man, but like, and Gio knows nothing about anything sports related. And so I was like, yeah, but like this Giannis Antetokounmpo gif could be like pretty sweet. And like that, and for what it's worth, NFTs all went up, Top Shot didn't, and Giannis won league MVP that year. So like, in hindsight, still feels like it should have been a good bet, but I guess Top Shot just executed poorly by flooding the market with inventory.
I've been there. I've had my fair share of poor buys on the NFT side. I think I probably lost 10 grand on Top Shot.
What was the deal with that? Maybe not to get too into it, but like, am I right in saying that they just flooded it with way too much inventory?
Yeah, they're doing like, oh, well, we'll do these drops every, you know, every Tuesday or whatever it was. Yeah. So they just, and they were huge drops. So they made tons of money, but
I think it's Draper Labs or something like that. It'd be cool if like the athletes got paid behind it or were more involved with it. And then I think there could be some value, but yeah. We probably should have put that on the tax write-off for last year. just send it to the IRS or my account already thinks I'm freaking crazy. Every year, just like April 2nd will come around and I'll just like send her an email with a bunch of files. I'm like, can you like fix all of this? And like, she's a beast. So she's like, yeah, of course, we'll take care of this. Now we're finally starting to get into like a little bit more organized QuickBooks action and everything like that.
Yeah, that helps.
Okay, I got a couple more things here. Just maybe for the last like 10 minutes here, we can kind of like just riff on like some ideas or anything, because I know like you see a ton of opportunities come across your plate every day. So maybe I'll give you like two topics, and you can maybe just like pick and choose which direction you want to go in. First is like general, like what industries are getting you excited right now? Maybe we kind of just talked about that a little bit from like the crypto/boring business side of things. And so if so, we can skip that unless there's something that you really have there that's exciting. Or the second thing that could be fun to chat about is like in that tweet, kind of bringing it full circle here, is you said like my future business will not be for sale. Like whatever you build next is like, that's yours. You're going to own it. And like, it's you maybe bring in an operator in the future and just like permanently own it. What would that future business be? Like, so either two directions, like your next business that you would love to maybe kind of start if it's in e-commerce, or just like broad level, like industries and ideas that are getting you excited these days.
Yeah. I think my answer might answer both of those questions. So what's next for me? I'm you know, going to continue running car covers, but my wife is building that TikTok audience. And I think if people were to do one thing, they don't have a lot of cash, building an audience, like spend your time really building an audience in one niche. What I've learned over the years is having an audience is probably one of the most valuable things that you can have. You know, when I was an affiliate, part of the reason why I had such a successful run is because I built that blog in public. And all the affiliate managers are like, oh, you know, do you want this exclusive offer so you can promote our network? And so I got all these different kind of exclusive access things because I was building in public. And so I would say I aim to build more in public for the next business. So that's the opportunity that I see is people becoming their brands. That's what we're doing for my wife, and then using that to launch products. So that's what I plan to do personally, and my wife is doing. And then the other thing that I'm excited about is Airbnbs. So I do want to own some rental vacation properties. You can use it yourself personally, like 2 weeks out of the year. So if we've got 6-7 houses, like, oh, we can go this one and this one and this one. And it's a bit of a boring business, but I love residential and commercial real estate. It's just,
I do think the cool part about some of the real estate stuff is when you can do the combination between like online marketing and really traditional just rental property, right? Like you can look at how do you build the Airbnb listing? How are you taking better photos than other people? What are, you know, what are keywords? How do you, Airbnb has those different categories now. There's definitely tips and tricks on how to get into and featured around there, right? Like there's always...
You guys, I think, had Isaac French on a few episodes ago. And he did
exactly, he's doing cool stuff.
Yeah, he's building an audience so that he can support his like kind of boring real estate business. And so I think building the audience is something that's a huge...
He's smart because he's doing it on two platforms as well, Instagram and Twitter. And he's using these two platforms differently. So the Twitter side, I know he's attracting some serious investor pool talent for like financing future deals. The Instagram side is from the booking element, right? Like, how can I go and get more bookings without having to pay these Airbnb commissions and maybe charge a higher premium, right? I think part of the downside of just being exclusive on Airbnb is there's that service fee. But on top of that as well, it's like, hey, if I want to charge $500 a night, everywhere else in the area charging $300 a night, like it's tough to compete. But if you just see it through the Instagram and you don't have a proxy in terms of like what you're comparing it against, it's, you're kind of in a market on its own, which is pretty
cool. It's a independent, so, like he's got his own e-commerce store versus doing something on, you know, Amazon or you own the customer in the end.
Yeah, exactly. And the law of comparison is such a powerful thing that it's hard for someone to go, oh, I'm paying 300, but you know, or 500 for this more premium one. What's, you know, so we actually even use that in our e-commerce business where we have like multiple price tiers and like this one, the top tier is stacked with so much extra value because people are set on like this one here is, you know, 150 and oh, for $20 more, I get this extra warranty and I get these free items and all that stuff. So it is a powerful thing to be able to use that comparative.
What you're saying though is too, in terms of like a difference for where things can go in the next couple of years is like with your wife, for example, this kind of goes back to like the 2010, like you build something, there's no reputational risk. Like right now it sounds like people really want to buy from people and like, especially giving like these online personalities and building up your brand there, like to be more successful today, it seems like one thing I can take away from this conversation is like, you have to have a little bit more skin in the game than you might've otherwise have had to in the 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, I think too, a lot of times these younger kids, they look at somebody like that, me, that's been doing it for 15 years and they think, oh, I need to, you know, I need, how do I get there? But you just got to take one step at a time. And, you know, as you build, you will get there. It's just all about compounding. Most of the wealth that I have has come in the last, like, you know, 5 years because it compounded to the point where it was actually pretty significant.
Yeah, so, I feel like you are living proof of like compounding, right? You start building websites when you're 11, you're 35 right now, giving away $10 million to charity. Like I'm excited really to see where you go in the next like 10 to 20 years. I got to imagine you're going to be working on some really cool things.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, hopefully we'll have some exciting things in the future.
But. Oh, yeah. And I'm also still so jealous of your setup right now. And people who are maybe watching this on video can see, actually, maybe this is a good plug to plug our YouTube. No, like people got to start checking out our YouTube stuff. So I'm going to plug it here. But like Johnny's got like this badass like katana in the background, some Tesla. He's got like this living wall of like that was like custom made. It looks really cool.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the katanas, my wife is half Japanese, so had to get like a real, like authentic katana. So
dude, I have no one in my life who's really Japanese, and so I still want a katana. Like if I ever get like a big exit, it's absolutely getting invested in
the katana. Is the first thing you're buying,
Johnny? This is a ton of fun, man. I think this covered everything and more than I wanted to get into, so I really appreciate you coming on. If people want to go and check you out, where can they find you?
Twitter at Jonathan Volk is my handle, but I go by Johnny Volk.
So. Right on. Johnny, thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, appreciate it. It's good.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.